Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us. In studio today, we have Benny White, who has a law degree and is with the Election Oversight and is co-hosting with me today. We also have Rich Fly, the president of Tucson chapter of FCEA, which stands for Armed Forces Communication and Electronics Association. And on the telephone, we have Ellen Espinoza, who is the special advisor to the North Texas InfraGuard and director of security operations for online business systems. Ellen, are you with us? Can you hear us?
I am. Good morning, Sherry.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay.
Good morning.
Before we start into some of the military and business business things, I want to talk to Benny. There's a couple of cases that are going on right now that we need to know about because politics starts from the ground up. So if you would, you'd tell us about the cases you were referring to.
Well, good morning, everyone. I hope to give you a little information today that'll help you understand some of the things that are being discussed in the news and will continue to be discussed until all of the election results this year are finalized. And they have to do with four different cases. The first case is a case that was decided by the Supreme Court in 2014. It was Tribal Commission of Arizona versus Arizona. That case had to do with whether or not the state of Arizona had to accept the National Voter Registration Form for voter registration. And in that case, the Supreme Court decided that Arizona did have to go back to the Election Assistance Committee and abide by their ruling that Arizona had to use those forms for voter registration. Prior to that date, Arizona had accepted those forms, but had not used them completely for voter registration. They would send out a letter and a voter registration application. The voter would then fill that out with the documented proof of citizenship and send it back. So what happened as a result of that decision in the Supreme Court, we set up in Arizona a system called Fed-only voting, both voter registration and voting, such that people that do not present documented proof of citizenship, which is required under Arizona law, could then vote in what we now call a federal election, where the president, U.S. senator, and U.S. House of Representative member is elected, but they can't vote on any of the state ballots. So that leads us then into another case that was decided in 2018 called LULAC versus Arizona. The issue there was whether or not when the recorders got a state voter registration form that did not have proof of citizenship accompanying it, whether or not that applicant had to be registered to vote. And the agreement by the Secretary of State at that time was that that application would be accepted, but again, only for federal voting, not for state voting. Then last year, there was a case that was brought by the Democratic National Committee that went through the local district court, then to the Ninth Circuit. And that case had to do with ballot harvesting and provisional ballots. That is still pending before the Supreme Court and will be decided next year. But the really important case right now that is pending is in the Ninth Circuit. It's a case called Mi Familia Vota. And that case was decided by the district court, Judge Logan, on Monday of last week. And then it was immediately appealed by both the Republican National Committee and the National Republican Senatorial Committee, who were parties to that suit. The Secretary of State has declined to appeal that decision. And what the decision said was that registration, which was supposed to be have a deadline of October 5th, which was Monday, is now extended until October 23rd. And so that case is pending in the Ninth Circuit. It is being appealed by the two plaintiffs or two defendants in the original case. But now the Attorney General of the state of Arizona, Mark Brnovich, has a motion pending to intervene in that case. And that is an extremely complicated civil case, but it will determine in the end, probably at the U.S. Supreme Court, whether or not a federal judge has the jurisdictional authority to make changes in the state election law. It's my position that they do not, but that'll be decided by 9 members of the U.S. Supreme Court, and that is why it is so important to fill that 9th seat on the Supreme Court that is currently vacant.
So if they don't have the authority to do what they're doing, and all these people who have been registering to vote after the 5th, what happens?
They will probably continue to be registered. The recorders will attempt to contact those voters, get proof of citizenship from them so that they can be legally registered under the laws of the state of Arizona. But
I knew right the other now, shoe was going to drop.
Yeah. But right now, what the court ordered the Secretary of State to do was to direct the county recorders to accept voter registrations up until the 23rd. The problem with that order is that the recorders do not work for the Secretary of State. The recorders only comply with Arizona law, and that has to be either in the statutes or in the election procedures manual. So the Secretary of State can write a change to the elections procedures manual, but that has to be approved by the Attorney General and the governor. The Attorney General is appealing the decision, so in all likelihood, he will not approve that change to the manual.
So she's stepping outside of her realm of authority.
Way outside her realm. And I don't know what the recorders are going to do with that. If I were the recorder currently, I would put all of those registration applications in a file and hold them pending the final resolution of the case, because you don't want to have ballots included from those newly registered voters that are eventually going to be declared invalid because the person couldn't be registered after the deadline.
Now, that's what I was wondering. And then if it all happens after the vote, after the election.
It's right now it's in limbo. We just do not have a decision. On Monday, the 9th Circuit is going to decide whether Mark Vernovich can represent the state of Arizona in the case. That is another complex question that has to be resolved by the court. So I don't see this being resolved probably prior to the election day.
Okay. Well, that's just more fun to look forward to.
Well, I think
everything's in limbo.
Yeah, I think the overall objective of the plaintiffs in this case is to do away with deadlines and mandate that all states have to have same-day voter registration.
It would, and you know what? Alan and I were talking about this yesterday. Was it yesterday? It seems like all my life ago. Alan, what were we talking about when it's a national convention or convention election that you would think there would be more national rules in place to govern that? Is he there?
Yeah. Yes, I certainly am. Yeah, absolutely. I'm certainly a proponent of having more, national rules, more federal rules governing that, especially sort of coming from my perspective of the technology realm, right, of information security. One of the major factors in this election, I mean, it's been true in past elections as well, but now it's, of course, more front and center, and the threat actors have increased, is the security of the ballots, right? And the tallying of those ballots in particular. So the security of the physical ballots, of course, which we've been hearing about in the news, and if they're sent in, mail-in ballots specifically, and the security around that and the integrity of maintaining those ballots from the time a person mails them to when they get into the appropriate hands to be tallied. But there's also the integrity of the election databases. And that's one of the items that's at the forefront of the government, a number of the agencies' minds. And that's that, each state has a voter database, right? And so part of what happens through the process is when the various precincts report their tallies, they send it into the state database, and there's a central repository, if you will, and they're validated there that those are people that should indeed be voting and such, as well as the results of those ballots. And those databases, well, they're sitting on various computer systems and networks. And they're vulnerable, you know, in one way or another. But just the fact that they exist, their mere existence, regardless of the controls that are in place, make them vulnerable to attacks by anyone, really. And in this election, more than anything, the concern is foreign actors. And I'll name them, and they're mainly Russia and China, who continue to want to influence this election continue to attempts, and to some degree very successful attempts, to influence the election. That's one way to do it, is to get to that database and either essentially lock it up, if you will, encrypt it with ransomware, or affect the results of it and affect the integrity of the data. And the other avenue that they've taken that seems to be a lot easier for them is going through social media and, you know, the foreign influence campaigns that they have begun quite a while ago, actually. They've been going on since the last election, for that matter. They haven't stopped, but they certainly ratcheted up in the last few months. And I could tell you, I definitely don't speak on behalf of the FBI, but they are a partner that I work with. And they are very concerned, and they actually have an initiative called Protected Voices that they started. And part of Protected Voices is to help educate the public in actually securing this election, if you will, or helping secure the election. And one of the key ways, aside from the cybersecurity, aside from having great processes in place and practicing, following best practices and good cyber hygiene. Aside from that, there's the social aspect of it, which technology cannot prevent. You know, Facebook is having a heck of a time, and so is Twitter and other platforms, but in particular, Facebook and Twitter are having a heck of a time identifying these foreign actors. Alan, because they pose as domestic. Yeah, please go ahead.
If I could ask a question here, one of the things that has become more popular in the recent years is the storage of these databases in what we term the cloud. As far as you're aware, are there ongoing surveillance activities to make sure that those cloud storage facilities are monitored so that we can detect any kind of intrusion into those? I know that's one of the things that we have worked with here in Pima County. We've been very reluctant to store things in the cloud because we don't have absolute control over that. That winds up being a third-party provider, and security is a real concern there for us.
Yeah, certainly. Yes, there is. There are concerted efforts. The government, the DHS in particular, stood up an entity a while back, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA for short. The website is CISA.gov, if anybody's interested, to help. Well, first of all, it was really set up to help secure, to focus on information security or cybersecurity for the entire country, right, and the federal government and such. But they right now have a concerted effort in securing the elections. And so to answer your question, yes, for the most part, when it comes at least to the federal government and, if you will, cloud, you know, storing data or utilizing cloud technology. And let me just make the distinction for the listeners just in case. When we talk cloud, it's essentially the equivalent of what a company would have on their premises in terms of equipment, except it's really sitting in someone else's place, if you will. That's really all what the cloud is, or the distinction is, right? So you, to your point, you don't have control over the hardware, right? You have less control over it. You could have a lot of control over a number of aspects of it, but essentially you don't have control over the hardware, and there's certain limitations. What the government does and utilizes is our instances of cloud instances, for example, in Amazon Web Services, or what's referred to as AWS, that there's a specific space called the Gov Cloud that's specifically for the government, right? So it's further regulated. It's monitored, you know, way beyond what, you know, perhaps you and I would just off the shelf go or subscribe to, right, with AWS. So there are those safeguards. If you're in the GovCloud, right, there are those extra safeguards. Now, not everybody's in the GovCloud. not everybody qualifies for it. And my understanding from dealing with local government is that there are a lot of local government agencies that are not. They don't have their systems there, so they're not afforded that extra protection. But there are other initiatives that are at work. For example, the Electronics Infrastructure Information Sharing and Analysis Center, which was stood up in 2018. So there are lots of different ISACs, we call them, Infrastructure Information Sharing and Analysis Centers. There's a multi-state one. There are all sorts of other ones. The election one specifically was stood up 2 years ago because it's become such an issue, right, that it had to be its own entity. And they work with not only federal, but they work with state and local government and tribes and various communities in helping them, further secure, providing guidance and tools and such to help further secure. And I'll mention one more real quick here, and that's CIS, who is a part of creating that ISAC. Actually has an election risk profile tool CISA created it, an election security risk profile tool. It's available online. It's available for free so that especially the smaller jurisdictions or just local government that maybe have less mature information security practices or experience or resources for that matter can utilize to help better protect themselves. So there are tools the government the FBI, DHS, CISA, the new ISAC that was stood up. There is a concerted effort to help, number one, protect the integrity of the data, which is extremely important, of course, and that's the part that's susceptible to hacking, as people term it, or some kind of a breach, or affecting the integrity in some way, shape, or form, or even locking it up for that matter through ransomware and making it unavailable. There's a concerted effort by a number of agencies to help protect against that sort of scenario. And then, I would say, just kind of separately to some degree, there's a concerted effort to mitigate the effects of the foreign influence, which are significant. Facebook and Twitter, I don't know if I finished that thought earlier, but Facebook and Twitter are having a heck of a time dealing with that, because we're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of accounts, the fake accounts that are created by foreign entities. And there are others, but they're typically Russia and China. And they create the fictitious accounts. They actually pay to have ads served. And, I'm sure you can all remember years ago receiving an email, a fictitious email from the prince, in Nigeria, telling you there's $3 million, right? Remember those?
My buddy, the prince.
Exactly, yes. And here's the thing. I could tell you, being in cybersecurity and being in IT for over 25 years, once upon a time, those emails were very poorly written, right? People still fell for them, but they were poorly written. If you got the email, you paid some attention, you'd realize, yeah, this is not legitimate. The English is horrible, whatever it is, right? The graphics on it, et cetera, all sorts of errors. The times have changed, and that's not the case anymore. And even for cybersecurity professionals like myself and the team I work with, it's even difficult for us to spot those, quite honestly. And we have to use all sorts of tools. So the point I'm getting at with that is, when it comes to these influence campaigns on social media, they're so sophisticated and well done. They really do look like they're being run by Americans, essentially, by folks here in our homeland, and by certain groups that they're posing as and such, whether it's one side, more Republican side or conservative side or Democratic side, right? So it's very difficult to tell. And the FBI, I know that they're working closely with Facebook and Twitter and other social media outlets to deal with this issue, but there's technology, there's artificial intelligence that has been improving and identifying these actors, but it's still not 100%, and folks are still being influenced. And, one of the things that the federal government puts out is to, always verify, to look for trusted sources. I'll say one last thing on the subject, and that is, I agree with them, of course, and support their position, but oftentimes a trusted source to a person is a friend. And I have to say that in these cases, that's really, you may not want to trust that source either, right? Because your friend is forwarding or liking a message on, let's say, Facebook about something to do with politics and to do with the election process and such. And frankly, they may have got it. They may have originated from a foreign influence campaign. It got to them. It gets perpetuated. Next thing you know, you're following it. You're perpetuating it as further as well. And more importantly, you're buying into it. And the reality is it's just a foreign influence campaign. And their goal, they have several goals. But right now, probably the most important goal for them is to erode confidence in our processes. They know this is the best country in the world. They know that, sure, we already know we have flawed processes. They're not perfect. But they want to erode confidence in our especially in the election process, and cause, you know, more dissension, more chaos, and in the meantime, you know, essentially distract us from what they're doing. And I won't get into what they're doing. The feds could talk about that, but they're doing all sorts of things. Yeah,
yeah. It seems like there's more and more of these propaganda ads going out. Rich, you were talking about, or not on air, but you were talking to me about the Election Security Group. What are they doing?
So it might be beneficial to kind of go back, and Alan touched on this a little bit, as far as the origination of the federal involvement, the DOD involvement in election security. So he touched on the fact that all of this kind of originated out of the 2016 election and what they had seen coming from foreign actors. I'm sure that there had been some level of involvement from foreign adversaries to do some sort of meddling within our elections, but it really came to a head in 2016. And the NSA and the U.S. Cybercom, or what eventually became U.S. Cybercom, U.S. Cyber Command, stood up what was known as the Russian small group to specifically target some of that disinformation, you know, the campaigns. I believe they refer to them as the influence operations. That's what General Nakasone of U.S. Cybercom referred to them as. The success that group saw, that the Russia small group saw from the 2016 and the midterm in 2018, led to the creation of the Election Security Group. They wanted to broaden that, the influence that they had, broaden their operations, broaden their capabilities, and provide that information sharing out to DHS, out to FBI, to provide them with those additional tools that they need to execute their side of the mission. Obviously, the NSA, U.S. Cybercom, they're not very interested in what goes on internally within the country. You touched on the cloud aspect, using cloud as a means to house the repository for voter information. They are interested in making sure that is a secure environment. They have stood up things like FedRAMP, which is the actual process that a cloud provider must follow in order to secure their system for GovCloud, for MilCloud, for anything where there's going to be national security data located on a public cloud environment. And to your point, as far as the Pima County's reluctance to utilize those types of platforms, all of the intelligence community uses them. They're processing classified information over them, but it's in a very, very select area within those cloud environments. So provided that Pima County can get access to something that has higher levels of security, I wouldn't go posting all your information out on just regular AWS instances, but provided that you can get access to those more cleared, more maybe not actually classified, but more secure areas, I don't think there should be any reluctance from the county to be comfortable doing that.
Well, I appreciate that response from a technical perspective. My concern here is on a logistical and personnel basis, our ability to recruit and retain a qualified IT personnel or cyber personnel that are proficient in dealing with all of these various infrastructures that are possibly available to us, and interfacing with the government officials that might be doing that kind of work. That seems to me that you need a very stable workforce that can have longevity in their positions and establish relationships with people that they work with so that everybody stays on the same page at the same time. You're not having people change in and out of job profiles from month to month or quarter to quarter, trying to learn all this acronym technology.
Yeah, you need somebody who's pretty stable and is consistently there in order to really secure everything. Do you have that with the recorder's office?
I'm not sure we do.
Okay.
And that is the difficulty that pretty much every agency faces. And a lot of the federal agencies, especially on the civilian side, they move more toward contractor-led, contractor-managed environments. And that brings its own challenges as far as maintaining it from the government side. But it takes the onus off of the government for having to hire, having to maintain, having to keep those people on staff, having to keep them abreast of any new innovations that are coming. It takes that onus off of you, and you basically become almost like the program manager alone to make sure that they are executing on what you have established as their parameters for maintaining that environment.
I appreciate that. Alan, I need to correct you. One statement that you made about the verification or certification of the election results, at least with regard to Arizona, that's done at the county level, and then those results are uploaded to the state level. That certification is not done at the state level in Arizona. So we do have that disconnected protection here, that if there is ever a problem detected, that we can go back down to the county level and a local level to verify the vote counts or the race counts here in Arizona. I'm not sure that's the case nationwide, but that is the situation here in Arizona.
Yeah, every county has their own little way of doing things across the country.
Well, and there's some protection in that. If an outside intruder wants to come in and change results, they have to deal with all those little different jurisdictions in order to have a significant income or input into something like a presidential election or a senatorial election. You have to deal with the entire state or the entire country in order to make a change.
So you're making it difficult on them.
Absolutely.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that, Benny. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few.
This is Maya Thompson, producer for Law Matters Live Show, airing Saturday mornings at 8, when our listeners ask questions of the people who have answers. On our next show, attorney Dawn Preston tells us what it takes to be a public defender for Pima County. This is your show, and we can't do it without your support. Please go to lawmatters1030.org to contribute. And if you missed us live, check our Law Matters on iTunes. Now get your questions ready and join our conversation at 790-2040. We thank you.
Getting a reverse mortgage with the new rules and expanded limits can be a positive, life-changing experience. The reverse offers multiple ways of having your equity work for you, from a monthly income, an interest-bearing equity account, or a total cash out. Give me a call and let's see which reverse option best works for your future plans. Call 520-310-9900. Ask for me, Sherry. That's 520-310-9900.
This is Nathan Chabon, producer for Law Matters. I have a goal to reach and I need your help. I want to put the DEA out of business. That's right, the Drug Enforcement Agency. If you have an addiction problem or know someone who does, please reach out to lawmatters1030.org and click the DEA tab for more information. Reaching out is the first step. We have the resources if you have the will. You can beat this demon and help me put the Drug Enforcement Agency out of business.
To report suspected human trafficking, please call the National Human Trafficking Resource Center at 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP or INFO to 233-733. To learn more about Homeland Security investigations and our efforts to combat human trafficking, please visit our website at www.ice.gov or check out the DHS Blue Campaign at www.dhs.gov/bluecampaign. For more information on the Southern Arizona Anti-Trafficking Unified Response Network, please visit us at www.saturn.org or find us on Facebook.
Thanks for staying with us. Our guests today are Benny White, and he's with the Oversight. He's helping me co-host the show today and keeping everybody honest. We have Rich Fly, who is the president of the Tucson chapter of FCIA, and Alan Espinoza, who is in Texas, and the director of security operations for online business systems, and also the special advisor to the North Texas InfraGuard, which is a huge, huge area. Rich, tell me about the statements that you handed me. Explain what's going on.
So General Nakasone, like I mentioned, he's the commander of U.S. Cybercom. He's also the director of the National Security Agency. He gave a speech at the Intelligence and National Security Summit last month, and that's where he called these the influence operations. And he said that these are going to pose an ongoing security threat for the U.S. intelligence community, the election environments, RNC, DNC, for decades to come. That statement has been backed up by the State Department. They feel the same way. So what he said was, obviously, this is the number one priority right now. We're less than a month away from the election. This is absolutely number one priority for the NSA, for the U.S. Cybercom, for the entire intelligence community. And he laid out three specific areas, three goals for the NSA as far as what they are operationally standing up, what they're operationally executing. So the first one was to generate insight on any of those adversaries, primarily those foreign adversaries. So as Alan had mentioned, specifically Russia and China, I think Russia very much specifically back in 2016, we saw some of that additional threat vectors come into play with social media in the 2018 midterms. We're seeing even more of it now. They want to generate as much information as far as what is being done within the environment, what they're seeing across the board, whether it's them trying to hack into those databases, whether that's them trying to create false Facebook accounts, Twitter, and sow distrust within the government. So
a lot of propaganda.
Exactly. They want to generate as much insight into that as possible, gather as much intelligence, gather as much information. They want to then take all that information, they want to share it with DHS and the FBI. They're also working relatively closely with Facebook and Twitter. They want to make sure that they're still maintaining the security of Facebook. They want to make sure that people's rights, people's First Amendment rights are still being upheld, but they want to keep those foreign adversaries from interfering in that. And they're towing a very fine line there. Like I said, they are working very closely with those two groups to make sure that they keep those foreign adversaries out. And then they want to pose outcomes on their adversaries who attempt to disrupt our democratic process. And whether that's bureaucratically, whether that's imposing sanctions, whether that's going on the offensive as far as cybersecurity and starting to actually attack those individual actors, whether they be state or whether they be state actors from a foreign perspective, or whether they be individuals, they want to actually go on, like I said, go on the offensive to try to keep them from interfering.
You know, it's like the damage is already done. I mean, they've put the propaganda out there. You've got a certain fraction of people that are going to be gullible enough to believe it. I'm surprised we don't have aircraft going overhead distributing flyers out their windows like they used to do. It's just, it's insane, some of the stuff you hear. And it seems like if they say it loud enough and long enough, people go, oh, it's got to be true. And it isn't. So what to do?
I feel that in a sense, and I'd hate to put it this way, it's kind of mission accomplished to some degree,
yeah.
You know, and that I think we see it. I believe we could all agree on this, that voter confidence has eroded significantly, that we are, as a country, essentially extremely focused on certain issues and maybe not on others. Let me just put it that way. I don't want to get too political. And this is a personal opinion. This is certainly not anything I've heard from the feds at all. But again, I just think there's part of the campaign of influence is also a campaign of distraction. You know, in the meantime, China, for example, continues to steal intellectual property to the tune of billions of dollars a year. And not that we're not aware of that, but you don't see that on the news. And that's not much of a discussion, you know, barely. I mean, it is within the government. You better believe it. They're hard at work against that as much as they can. But in the meantime, you know, we're focused on some other things. Again, not to take merit off of the subject matter. I think there are a lot of issues that do warrant discussion and focus. But, you know, I tend to be concerned about where a lot of the focus is, quite honestly, and where it's not. And in particular, you know, with China, I'm just going to point them out again, and what they're doing with intellectual property. And they're taking, you know, money away from American businesses without us shipping manufacturing there. Aside from all that, aside from what we manufacture there or what we source there, aside from that part, which is a whole other discussion, which I'm certainly not qualified to talk about, just in the intellectual property alone. So just a thought there.
And I'm very glad you mentioned that, because there's something that doesn't get much press, and I'm not really sure why. I was in a meeting maybe a year and a half ago in a briefing with the Navy with Vice Admiral Moran. He's with the Naval Sea Warfare Center, and he was actually talking about that, about the efforts that the Chinese have taken over the past 10 years or so within the supply chain of defense contractors. So they will... A lot of the information that's sent downstream from the prime contractor all the way down to the subcontractors that support the prime contractor, a lot of that information at the top level is classified. So access to that information is very difficult to obtain for somebody like a China. But access downstream, because it's been segmented so many times, that information becomes non-classified because you have compartmentalization. They go after those people. They go after the small businesses that don't have the levels of security within their IT infrastructures to be able to support not getting hacked and not getting that information out there. And the information that they're obtaining from an individual subcontractor really isn't anything for them to build anything off of. It's a small compartmentalized piece of an overall program. But if you gather enough of those individual pieces, you can build the whole puzzle and you can see exactly what's going on. So to combat that over the past couple of years, Ms. Katie Arrington at the Office of Undersecretary of Defense has implemented a process called CMMC, which is the Cyber Maturity Model Certification, which now is going to require all small businesses who operate within the DoD space, whether you are a subcontractor, prime contractor, whatever process you execute under to support DoD, you are now going to have a level of cybersecurity maturity that you have to obtain in order to continue to do that work. And that's something, again, I don't feel like that has gotten enough press. That's something that has been needed for 15 or 20 years. And I think that's going to have a real impact in China's ability to continue to do intellectual property rights. Theft is basically what it is.
I have a question. You may not be able to address it right now, but have we seen a change in the vulnerability of our defense establishment caused by the work at home that's been imposed by our defense contractors in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis, where businesses have shut down, but the workers are now working at home on all these intellectual property types of projects?
So from what I've seen, and maybe Alan can talk on this as well, from what I've seen, no. And you would kind of expect there to have been some sort of an impact, some sort of an effect. But they have implemented certain platforms, certain systems that allow them to maintain that level of security. And I won't go into specifics. I'm not sure what I can and can't talk about. But they do have systems available to them that that support cross-domain security, that allow them to access classified information, classified documents over unclassified networks, and still maintain that level of classification.
Good.
Okay. Alan, did you want to comment?
No, right on. I agree. That's indeed the case. And the government realizes that, like a lot of corporations are realizing, that while the pandemic will, let's just say, eventually, you know, die down and go away, so to speak, the change that it's created in society and the work from home and working remotely is not going to go away. And so they, you know, to this point, and I agreed 100%, have already taken steps, and they're continuing to take steps to deal with this issue. Because the reality is that, you know, again, without going into detail either, you know, typically you're going to access classified information. You have to be sitting at a computer that essentially has a green sticker on it, if you will, you know, and log into that computer using a smart card and some other biometrics and such in order to authenticate. Well, you know, there are folks that are, for various reasons, not able to come to the office, whether it's a health matter, they're immunocompromised or whatnot, or just don't feel comfortable, but we have to continue with business, right? Whether it's a defense contractor or whether it's the government. So agreed, measures are definitely in place now, and they're further securing and maturing those measures. So I don't foresee that really being a problem. I think the problem that has existed, which is foreign actors infiltrating, you know, certain corporations as well as the government. It just, it exists. It's existed. It's been a problem. It's going to continue to exist, you know, whether we work remotely or we work from the office. And that's a whole other challenge that I think you could probably talk about another show, but I'll leave it at that.
Can any of you address this QAnon situation? Do you know anything about it?
I don't.
Alan, do you know anything about it?
Sorry, I do not either.
Okay. Well, in a couple of weeks, we're going to have an FBI agent on who seems to know about it. And it just seems like there's a lot of myths out there, and people are perpetuating these myths, like the one with the Wayfair, you know, the situation with that, and some pizza delivery company. I'm just like, people are believing this. And it's just beyond my comprehension.
There's a reason people say, I read it on the internet.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I'll say this in the defense, if you will, of a lot of folks. I sometimes don't blame folks for believing it, because there are, you know, I'll use an example. There's a website I'm sure you're familiar with called Wikipedia, right? And it's sort of the encyclopedia of the internet, and it's crowdsourced. So Wikipedia, you and I could go right on Wikipedia right now. I could post an entire page on Sherry Harrison, right, and all your accomplishments, and I could say whatever I want, and it would necessitate, if I put citations there, if I cited the information somehow, which of course I could cite another site that's fictitious, you know, if I wanted to. But if I did that and no one challenged it, then it would just stay there. It would stay up there, actually.
And people think Wikipedia is really like an encyclopedia. It's got to be true.
Correct.
They do it. I'm picking on, this is just one website, right, that I'm picking, just one. But just to give you an example, and I personally, it was, I forget how long ago, it was over 10 years ago, that when I looked at Wikipedia, I thought, wow, this is going to be very dangerous. It made me truly very, very nervous, because people are going to post what they want on there, and if they somehow cite it, which is not hard, it is not hard for me to create a website right now and say that, you know, whatever, that you're the you know, the, something, right, and perpetuate fake information. It's not hard to do that, and if that's the way it's going to work, and then people are counting on it, people are, again, there are many other sites, many other forums, but I'm picking on one. But Wikipedia is a great example, because there's, I'm sure, I don't have statistics, by the way, but I have no doubt there's a lot of false information or inaccurate information on there. And I don't blame someone that maybe doesn't understand how that necessarily works for reaching the site, because they did a Google search or a search engine search of some kind, and they ended up at Wikipedia, and they learned that, you know, I'm the king of North Texas when I'm not, you know, kind of thing.
You're so not?
It's I'm not. I know I tend to think I am, but I'm definitely not. So my point is to say that there, you know, people definitely need to exercise wisdom in not only what you read, where you get it from, and what action you take with it. Although I think it, more than anything, it pulls at the heartstrings. And that's what the foreign campaigns know to do well. They've learned how to do that extremely well, to pull at our heartstrings. And once you pull at someone's heartstrings, it's hard. It's not impossible, but it's difficult to then look at something objectively or more logically, or to research it, et cetera. So, you know, they're certainly using wisdom in what you read and where you get your information from. But at the end of the day, for just kind of a typical citizen that isn't a cybersecurity expert or attorney or et cetera, fill in the blank, it's kind of hard. It's difficult to, you know, if we maintain the internet as it is, as free as it is, which that's part of our democracy, is to have that, right, to have that freedom of speech and that platform. If it stays that way, which I believe it will, as long as we're a free and democratic country, we're going to have this problem. And so we're going to have to lean on each other, lean on folks like you, Sherry, and the other two gentlemen on this call with me, lean on folks like us and the federal government and others to provide information. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention InfraGuard, of course. And if folks are not familiar with InfraGuard, please look it up. It's InfraGard, no U in it, .org. It's a partnership that the FBI created a number of years ago to help better collaborate with the private sector to help protect critical infrastructure. And this is part of what we talk a lot about in InfraGuard, and it's part of our campaign in InfraGuard to get information out, to get the right information out to equip folks. So it's yeah.
I know what you're talking about, too, because Google Play, somebody has been putting our podcast on Google Play without my permission, using a different logo, and I just found out about it a couple of days ago. Not happy, but we do have our podcast on iTunes and apparently Google Play, and we're still researching how did it get there and why are they using a different logo? What's going on here?
Congratulations! It's you know, it's kind of like negative news is sometimes better than no news, so to speak, for some companies or celebrities. Someone put it out there for you, but yeah. That's not unusual.
Yeah.
Rich?
And Alan, you had touched on something there that I think should be far more influence in that discussion, and that's what people decide to do with the information that they get. I think that matters more than what people realize. And you talked about it really early in this discussion that people are getting information from people that they know, and they're almost more inclined to believe that information because it's from somebody that they know. They feel like this is trustworthy information because this is coming from someone that I know. But if that person that it's coming from didn't bother to cross-check it, didn't bother to verify the validity of it, then now you are receiving and will most likely perpetuate additional false information.
And that's rolling downhill.
Yeah, and I think that, and you're right, I agree that particular subject really needs to be spoken about a lot more. It's not. And I just venture to say, again, not a psychologist, but I would venture to say that a part of what happens is how it pulls at our heartstrings, right? I think if I forwarded a message to a friend about, I don't know, you know, how such and such barbecue grill is not a great grill, he'd probably not think much of it and think, all right, yeah, whatever, maybe I won't buy that, I'll look into it, you know, et cetera. But if it's a message about some issue that they're passionate about or that's, you know, frequently on TV and has been stirring us up, I don't know about y'all, but I'm quite stirred up, quite honestly, to the point that I don't want to look at the news anymore, then that's where it takes over. That's where, you know, to your point, there. It's not verified, and we, you know, it's interesting. I think it is important, and this is a philosophical matter, but I think it is important in society for us to indeed trust each other. I think that is very important. I don't believe, and I don't subscribe to the motto, if you will, of not trusting anyone. That's just not possible. You're not going to live a healthy life, really, or it's really impossible in a sense for that to be true. I think we do need to trust each other, but I do think we also need to realize that, you know, what someone says is going to be their opinion, however that's formulated, right? Just like I have mine, it's been formulated based on my experience, and some of that experience could be accurate and good, and some of it could be corrupt and wrong in some way, shape, or form. So, definitely more discussion on that. I agree 100%. Would love to see more of an emphasis on that. But social media, I mean, wow, in the last, let's just say 10 years, 10 to 13 years, it's just really, it's really changed. It's really changed that aspect for us as a society, significantly changed. I don't know if we go back, when we go back, how it's solved. I don't have the answers, but there's certainly a significant enough change, and now we're seeing the effects of it. I believe we're now starting to really see the effects of the negative effect. There's a lot of great things about social media. The negative effects of the power of social media, the power of not just a friend calling you and saying, hey, you know, I heard such and such thing, but rather you're seeing it on your phone when you're sitting wherever in a coffee shop, at work, on the bus. And there are graphics that are created to further pull at your heartstrings. And again, the people that do this stuff, it's been so well thought out that it's just amazing. To me, it's amazing at this point.
The internet is gossip. That's everything on there is just gossip.
Unverified gossip.
Unverified gossip. It's like playing telephone. And I can give you an example. When I was in Chicago, I got out of bed one morning and threw my back out. I ended up being transported to the hospital. And by the time my story filtered through the chain of command where I worked, the nurse at the work called me and said, "What were you doing on the roof that you fell off?" So...
Wow.
I know.
That didn't take long.
I wasn't on the roof. Dead of winter. But, you know, it was just like, this is all gossip. And unless you hear something come out of, like, especially with the candidates, unless it comes out of their mouth, you can't believe some of the stuff that's going around.
Yeah, even on the news, you see titles of articles that lead you to believe that the article is about one thing, and then you dig into it, you actually read the article, and that's not at all what it was about.
It's so misleading, yeah. And they've been doing this, for 4 years, yeah. That I, you know, have been paying attention to it, so.
And I think the problem is that people don't realize that this is, to borrow a term from cybersecurity, this is a threat vector.
It is.
Absolutely, whether it's internally used or whether it's a foreign adversary coming in and using that as their means to, you know, like I said, sow distrust, it is absolutely a threat vector. And you need to do your own independent verification of information that you're receiving and come to your own conclusions, come to your own opinions.
And some of the, you know, the people will say, you know, check out the source of that information. But a layperson like myself, I can look at an IP address and not know who it's from or believe who it's from when it's really not necessarily what it appears to be.
Sure.
So what are your suggestions for checking out these IP addresses? How do you know?
A lot of times you can't. So I did network protection for the Network Enterprise Technology Command down at the Army 20 years ago. That hurts. and we would do cross-checking against IP addresses to see where that information was coming from, where the threat was coming from. But we could only take it so far. You know, these guys are good at what they do. You know, to Alan's point, they have had years of practice. They have lots of money behind them to get really good at what they're doing. They can filter that information through systems that they have previously owned before. So for you as a layperson without access to some of the tools that maybe the Defense Department has, honestly, I could say it's next to impossible for you really to absolutely know 100% where that information's coming from.
Do you think they'd loan me any of those tools?
They might have to make you go through a pretty substantial background check.
Just checking. It doesn't hurt to ask. So, Benny, what's going on this week with voting?
Well, we have about 500,000 ballots have been mailed in Pima County. All the voters, I think, are in the process of receiving those ballots. They don't all come on the same day. But please take that ballot, carefully decide who you're going to vote for, mark it appropriately, make sure that you sign the affidavit on the white envelope before you mail it back, and then get it back to the recorder. You can put it in the mailbox. You can drop it off at any of the recorder's early voting sites, and those can be found on the recorder's website.
And you can track your ballot. Tell them how to do that.
And you can track. There's a ballot status link on the recorder's website. The website has recently been updated, so you'll see a traditional sometimes, or you may opt for the modern. But anyway, you can find that link to track your ballot. And if all else fails, walk it into any polling place on election day, and you can drop it in a box, and no identification or anything is required. You just drop it off and leave, and that'll get counted.
Okay. For anybody who wants to know more about Benny, who has a law degree and knows so much about the voting process, how do they get to your website?
Well, I have to just go to bennyforrecorder.com, bennyforrecorder.com.
Okay, you spell out four?
Yes.
Okay, just thought I'd ask.
I'm kind of simple-minded.
You're okay.
It's called old school.
Old school, exactly. Okay, I want to thank everybody. I mean, you know, Rich, you came down from Phoenix to be in studio, and I really appreciate that. Benny, thank you for getting up early and Alan, you didn't get up early, but thank you for calling in. I learned a lot. And I want to talk to you about something. Can I call you over the weekend?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Pleasure. Thank you, Sherry, for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Stay local. Shop local. Stay safe. Vote.
This is Maya Thompson, producer for Law Matters Live Show, airing Saturday mornings at 8, when our listeners ask questions of the people who have answers. On our next show, attorney Don Preston tells us what it takes to be a public defender for Pima County. This is your show, and we can't do it without your support. please go to lawmatters1030.org to contribute. And if you missed us live, check our Law Matters on iTunes. Now get your questions ready and join our conversation at 790-2040. We thank you.